Hey there. Before we get into today's episode, I have a quick favor to ask. If you love this show, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts and rate and review us. It really helps other people find us, and it helps us know what you're liking and want to hear more of. Thank you. On with the show. This is In Conversation from Apple News. I'm Shamita Basu. Today, the dark side of the global human egg trade. Like millions of people around the world, Maria knew that she wanted to have kids. She was in her late 30s, and she and her husband weren't able to conceive on their own. So they decided to try in vitro fertilization, IVF, in their home country of Greece. Their first two attempts failed. Then in 2020, on their third try, the clinic told her they successfully retrieved six eggs from her ovaries. A few weeks later, Maria was pregnant. 4 years went by when Maria, who is using a pseudonym for this story, was summoned to the local police station. Waiting there for her were two police officers and a psychologist. And what they told her, she found completely devastating. The fertility clinic she'd worked with actually retrieved double the number of eggs they told her. And those eggs had been used to create embryos for another woman.
The egg is the most precious resource in fertility, and it is limited.
That's Susan Burfield, a senior investigative reporter at Bloomberg Businessweek.
Despite all the technology, you still need an egg and a sperm to create a baby, and sperm is pretty easy to come by.
In a deeply investigated piece, Susan and a team of reporters tell the stories of Maria and four other women who willingly or unwillingly are part of the global human egg market. Here's Natalie Obiko-Pearson, another reporter on this story.
The person who is seeking the procedure is willing to pay almost anything. They're willing to drain their bank accounts to pay for it. And that, unfortunately, means that the power balance usually is with a higher-paying customer who is able to compensate a woman that is less privileged who needs that money and so is therefore selling her eggs.
In the U.S., a woman can sell her eggs for anywhere from $5,000 to $100,000, and costs vary widely in different countries. The scarcity and value of human eggs has given rise to a booming global market already worth billions of dollars. For so many people, it gives them the invaluable gift of a baby. But because the market is so sprawling and largely unregulated, it's also ripe for exploitation, particularly for those providing the eggs. We'll come back to Maria's story in a bit. But first, I sat down with Susan and Natalie to talk about how the lack of transparency and oversight in the international egg trade made it incredibly difficult to report on.
Just to capture how opaque this market is globally, I think it's something like an estimated 130-plus countries today you can have IVF done. But probably in a good 80%, maybe 85% of those, like, we don't even know how many clinics operate in those countries. So those are countries where they may not even have any fertility laws on the books, may not have a regulator. And just because of how globalized this business has become, it's very easy for clients all across the world to travel to places like that. So it was really difficult trying to get our hands around how many eggs are being sourced, where are they going to, where are people traveling to. We gave it our best shot by seeking records in 15 different countries where there is some data. But I think the conclusion we landed on is that nobody is really looking at the cross-border trade of eggs.
Mm. And from looking at all of this data, are you able to tell who are the donors? Who's selling their eggs? Who are the clients? Who are they selling eggs to or for?
We both pause because... those are excellent questions that are really hard to answer in the aggregate. And that's why we focused on countries where we knew there was a lot of either egg donation or potentially exploitation, or where there are a lot of people coming to seek, services that require using someone else's eggs. But, there are all kinds of reasons for people to use another woman's eggs, but one thing that they all probably have in common is that they can afford it.
Yeah, right.
So if you wanted to describe the people who are buying people's eggs, well, they're spending a lot of money. Both the woman gets paid, and often she'll have an agent who will also get paid. So it's expensive. And again, it's not something that insurance will cover in most cases, or cover as many times as many would-be parents seek services.
And I think on the donor side, I mean, even the word donor actually makes me really uncomfortable.
Yeah.
It's the word that...
Say more about that, Natalie, actually.
The word donor is used by the industry oftentimes to help convince young women to sell their eggs. And I think by framing it as donor, as you are doing something good for another family, you are helping another woman, that sort of masks this fundamental squeamishness that we have about paying for human tissue. Like, eggs are very unusual in that sense. We don't allow the transaction of human tissue generally. Like, countries ban things like the sale of organs for good reason. The human egg, somehow we've sort of set it apart a little bit and said it's okay to pay for them. But to say so directly is very, very uncomfortable. So oftentimes it's also framed as, well, we're not paying for your eggs. We're paying for your time and compensation.
And I would say, you know, it helps smooth over some complicated moral issues, not just for the women who are selling the eggs, but for the people who are buying the eggs. I think most people would feel better thinking that the woman who is giving them eggs is doing it for altruistic reasons because she wants to help create a family. And it's not to say that that isn't part of any woman's calculation. I think it is. But there is also on top of that the financial incentive that makes people uncomfortable.
Natalie, can you describe exactly what extracting someone's egg involves? Because this is not a simple procedure.
Sure. And I was actually an IVF patient myself once, so I had my own eggs extracted. So I went through, I think, about 2 weeks of hormonal injections. I remember feeling like a pincushion at the end of it. I can't remember how many times a day, but you're like injecting yourself in the abdomen. The hormones wreak havoc with your emotions. I felt so bloated. And then the day comes when you go in for the retrieval. So then they wheel you into an operating room. They give you anesthesia. You go under. It's quite short. I think it's usually only about a 10-minute procedure. I'm glad I didn't see this part, but they will take like a 35-centimeter needle, very, very long, push it up your vagina, pierce the vaginal wall, and then they go in. You've got what are called follicles developing on your ovaries. So they will sort of suck out the eggs from those follicles and put them into a petri dish, and then off they go and get fertilized by the sperm. One thing I think when I began first researching this topic, I kept going back to what had happened to me. And I said, you know, I actually have no idea how many eggs they extracted from me. I only have the word of the doctor. And I also had this procedure done in India, which was a country I was reporting on. And that actually really horrified me. I was like, the amount of trust that we put in an industry that is in many ways self-regulated, and that there is not a lot of transparency. Most fertility specialists I know are ethical, but it only takes a few bad apples. And I think,
as you found in your reporting.
Yes.
Yeah.
And the repercussions of some of the bad things that can happen reverberate across the world and in some cases across decades.
Well, let's start talking about some of these stories and some of these different profiles that you came across of people who gave their eggs, sometimes unwillingly. And maybe India is a good place to start in that case. Natalie, you reported on a young teenager who essentially was coerced into selling her eggs. Can you tell us a little bit about her story?
Sure. So this was a young girl in the city of Varanasi. It's sort of ironically the spiritual capital of India, place of pilgrimage. She came from a poor family there. And the way this industry works, there are agents across cities that sort of word of mouth, word travels, this is how you can make money. This young girl, we don't know her age exactly because she didn't have any birth certificates, but we estimate she's about 13, 14 years old. She was in seventh grade at the time. She went over to her grandmother's house at one point, and there was an Auntie Seema in the neighborhood, and she told Auntie Seema, I really want to buy a mobile phone. She'd already asked her mom for one, but her mom was like, we don't have enough money, maybe later on. And so Seema said, hey, I have an idea how you could make enough money to buy a cell phone.
Seema promised the girl, who isn't named in the story, a quick way to make 15,000 rupees, the equivalent of 180 US dollars, by selling her eggs. There was only one problem. The minimum legal age to donate eggs was 23. So Seema figured out how to make her seem older, even arranging a fake ID. Here is the girl talking to Natalie for this story. She said she was given a pinch of red vermilion powder in her hair and a wedding necklace, signs of a married woman, and a toddler to hold. She was told to lie and say that she had two children. But Natalie said there is no way they were convinced that this girl was old enough to be selling her eggs.
I met her, and there's no way you can mistake her as 24 years old, which is what her fake ID said. And I'm thinking to myself, you've had ultrasounds, you've had inspections. How do you mistake a 13, 14-year-old girl who has never given birth with a 24-year-old mother who has supposedly had two children?
The doctors at the clinic went ahead with the procedure. Seema ultimately gave the girl 11,600 rupees, around $130, after taking a cut for herself and others working with her. The girl got her phone, but her mother soon realized something had happened to her daughter, even though she wasn't sure what. So she called the police.
A lot of people did not understand exactly what egg donation is, and they conflate it with sexual assault or sex work. When the mother first filed the police complaint, she said, "Something bad has happened to my daughter. She's a virgin. Please help her."
Word spread further, and the girl was so shamed by the stigma of the procedure that she dropped out of high school. She told Natalie people passed comments, called her names. You hear her there saying, in this generation, if anything happens with a girl, people will end up blaming the girl. This is what happened with me. What happened to me was wrong, but I am the one to be blamed. The police arrested Seema and four others who were behind the girl's recruitment. And when they confiscated their phones, they found evidence of forged documents for underage girls being used at multiple clinics. But the consequences didn't go further than that.
None of the doctors at the clinic or the clinic itself has been held responsible. The other thing that was really remarkable when we went back to the records was that that group of four or five individuals had been working with clinics across the city. And these were other major chains in India that are also backed by Western financiers. The police had done nothing with that information. It was sort of like, let's lock away the four or five little guys and then wash our hands of the case.
Mm. You mentioned Western financiers. And this particular clinic was part of a huge IVF chain in India called Nova that has been backed by several U.S.-based investors. And I understand that you reached out to some of the big financiers for this reporting that you did. They did not respond to your request for comment. But can you tell me more about the role that investors and private equity play in all of this?
I think in this particular example, we found that Nova IVF had grown very, very fast over a period of about 7-8 years after Western private equity money had come in. And we interviewed many former employees who spanned that period and talked about the pressure to scale was so much that, and there were warnings that standards, clinical standards were falling, that they were growing too fast. And in fact, at one point, Nova had had a Spanish partner, and one of the executives at the Spanish partner had said, you know, I was really worried about the risks to us of like something going off the rails. And that's why that partnership had ended. And there was something very sort of prescient about that because he was saying, we're growing too fast. There's no way we can keep watch all of this properly. And it's just around that time that this case happened.
Mm. Well, let's turn now to Taiwan. Susan, you reported on young women there who set out to really make their living selling eggs. And they come to the United States to do it, which we should say is illegal. Tell us a little bit about the two women in particular that we meet in this reporting, Brandy and Amber. They refer to themselves as egg girls.
Yeah. So Amber was a graduate student in Taiwan and was looking for a quick way to make some money. And she did a search. And the first result was something equivalent to like an escort or kind of working at a nightclub. Mm-hmm. And the second was to be an egg donor, as it was called, in the U.S., and she could make $10,000. So she chose the second option. and the ability for her and for others to go to the U.S., you know, was really facilitated by a network of agents that were operating both in Taiwan and in the U.S., mostly in California. And it was connected to changes that were going on in China. So in China, there had been one-child policy for many years, we know. Right. And then that was lifted. And there was a push, actually, for families to have more than one child. At the same time, the government limited access to fertility services. So only married heterosexual couples could even receive any kind of fertility treatment. And surrogacy and paid egg donation was prohibited. And so that kind of gave rise to a pretty big group of Chinese parents who had the means but couldn't access the services. And so they started coming to the U.S., to California, and they wanted eggs from Chinese women. There were not enough Asian Americans willing to sell their eggs to meet the demand. And so people started recruiting from Taiwan. And Amber very quickly found an agent. She had never been to the U.S. before, but she got on a plane and was coached on how to mislead customs officials if they ask questions. Mm-hmm. So, you know, Amber, Brandy, most of the girls that we spoke to had all been coached on what to say and how to answer questions, how to scrub their phones of any messages, delete, you know, any apps, to have an itinerary that obviously did not include a visit to the fertility clinic, mm-hmm. and, you know, and to have a place to stay when in fact they maybe have been put up either with their agents or arrangements that their agents had made. So for Amber, she had to do all of this on her own, and her initial retrieval was pretty successful. They extracted more than 30 eggs. She knew right away that that would allow her to charge more for the next round. And, you know, Amber said, "My eggs are like a treasure."
Yeah.
You know, and that first time was the first time that she realized that she could, you know, like if you want to think of it as a resource, that she could kind of mine the resource for her own benefit.
And how many times can you go back and keep mining that resource? Because as we said from the very start, this is a finite resource, as we know, a very precious one. But how many times can a woman decide to give eggs?
So there's a guideline in the U.S., which I think is pretty widely accepted globally, that a woman should limit the retrievals to six.
Six cycles.
Mm-hmm. Amber, in the course of our reporting and talking to her, she completed a total of 16.
16 cycles. Oh, wow.
Yeah.
What are the health risks that are meant to be avoided by giving too many times?
So there's something called ovarian hyperstimulation syndrome. And what that means is that, you know, the hormones themselves trigger what can be a dangerous response in the woman. There can be fluid buildups, ovary can be twisted. In very, very rare cases, OHSS, as it's known, can lead to death. Mm. But more common is the kind of initial discomfort. So that's why there is a guideline, because the more hormones you inject, you do raise the risk. And the more eggs you produce, the risk increases.
Mm. I also just wanted to jump in and point out that in most countries, we are not capturing the full number of ovarian hyperstimulation syndrome cases. And the reason for that is you think about the incentives, right? Like the clinic patient, paying patient is an IVF patient. They're bringing in the egg donor to help that patient. The egg donor provides their eggs and goes away. Oftentimes, the symptoms can come up delayed days or even weeks. At that point, the egg donor is probably not going to go back to the clinic for help. They're going to go to a hospital. And the symptoms can be all sorts of different symptoms. So the doctors at the hospitals may not necessarily realize or recognize it as OHSS. They recognize it as fluid accumulating in the lungs or around the heart. You could capture it better, but there's no incentive to do so. And there have been cases of audits around the world. I talk about one in the Australian state of Victoria, which is probably one of the best regulated markets in the world. They went back and compared hospitalizations with self-reported OHS cases coming from the clinics, and they found that way more women were ending up in hospital.
Which tells us what exactly?
It tells us that OHSS, like moderate to severe cases, are actually much more common than the industry perhaps even realizes themselves.
You know, it's interesting reading the perspectives of some of these self-labeled egg girls. And some of them in the piece even say, you know, men give sperm, men are paid to donate, quote unquote, donate sperm all the time. So why is there so much judgment toward, stigma attached to women who are doing the same with their eggs? How did you two find this question unfold over the course of your reporting?
Part of the discussion that we had amongst ourselves and also, you know, with the women that we were talking about was to get at the question of agency and their willingness to participate in this. In the case in India, you know, it's very, very clear that this young girl was lured into something that she really didn't understand. In the other cases, there is almost a kind of feminist impulse behind it. And that's something that Amber spoke about with us. Her view was that this is her body, that she's discovered that her eggs are very valuable, that by selling them, she doesn't necessarily jeopardize her own ability to have kids, and that she can do something good for people while making money. Mm-hmm. And why should anybody think there's anything wrong with that? But one thing that most of the young women that we interviewed weren't really grappling with is the fact that there would be children as a result of their egg sales. And we're seeing this in the US and elsewhere with the men who have sold their sperm over the years, that there's maybe hundreds of kids, right, who are able now through 23andMe and other technology to identify who their biological father is. That's likely to be also the case, you know, with the women who have donated eggs. And I think there's a lot of very ambivalent feelings about that. Mm. In addition to all of the kind of gendered expectations we have for women and their reproductive health and their role as kind of mothers and their role in families.
We've talked about a lot of the problems that egg donors face, from being exploited to being unaware of potential health consequences. Is anyone addressing solutions here? I mean, after all of your reporting, what do you think would help make this process more transparent for both donors and recipients?
In the US, as we talked about, there's a guideline that limits women to 6 retrievals or cycles. That's really not enforced. And the way things exist now, it's really impossible to enforce because, you know, the women can go to different clinics and there's no tracking system. There's a law that's going to, I guess it's just gone into effect in Colorado, to limit the number of families that sperm or egg donors can contribute to. Hmm. So, you know, that was pushed by advocates working, you know, for the donor-conceived individuals. So, you know, there's small ways. In the US, there's been talk of some kind of registry, but, you know, the industry is very wary of any efforts to regulate and monitor it. And people are also wary of the government being involved. I think there's lots of smart people who are thinking about this, but I don't think there's an enormous incentive for anybody in the US right now to really be pushing for this.
To be honest, I think the solution is actually quite simple, but it would be one that would be incredibly difficult to implement. If you had a central registry, and Spain, for example, is one country has this, they have a central nationally run registry where every donor is recorded. So you know how many times she's donated and you know where her eggs have gone. But then this gets back to our quandary of when one jurisdiction becomes more tightly regulated or better oversight, the demand moves elsewhere. So really, you would need a central database, central registry for the whole world. And we know how difficult something like that would be.
It's really important to think about that because, I mean, that was the kind of basis for our story. And we saw it even as we were reporting. You know, there's bans on surrogacy for foreigners in India and Nepal. And then it moved to Thailand and then Thailand banned it. Then it moved to Cambodia. Cambodia banned it. But there are still people who want that. So where will they end up? And We even were able to report on Amber's own experiences selling her eggs in China, where it is forbidden. So, you know, the industry operates in the open in many places, and there's gray markets and there's black markets. There's always going to be demand, and there will always be people willing to supply the eggs.
To go back to the story of Maria, the mother in Greece who learned that her eggs had been given away without her consent, she found out from the police that at least 75 cases like hers have been identified at the same clinic. Greece had become a popular place for people seeking fertility services as laws tightened elsewhere. The clinic Maria went to has since been shuttered, and an investigation is still underway. 8 staff members were arrested for participating in a criminal network, and they're awaiting trial. All Maria has, by way of record keeping, is a tracking number, the code attached to her eggs that ended up somewhere else. Every so often, she thinks about going on social media and posting that code, seeing if she can find others from the clinic, someone who might say, "Yes, my files match your tracking number. My child came from your egg." It's a long shot, she knows. Maria says it's not like she wants to take anyone's child away from them, but she just wants to know whether there is a son or daughter out there. The pain of not knowing is something she lives with every day. While Maria's story, as well as the one from India, are harrowing, there are, of course, lots of positive, consensual stories in the egg donation business.
This industry is not black and white. For every case that you find of somebody who's been exploited or coerced, there's also stories of beautiful families that have been made. So it's not always exploitation, and it's not always really tragic victims. I mean, it just captures such a wide range of society.
I asked Natalie and Susan what someone who's considering using donor eggs for their family should keep in mind as they explore this option.
I think they should think hard about where the egg is coming from and how much they know about the individual that's donating it. And part of the argument for that is, of course, you know, as somebody who's accepting a donor egg, you want to know that it was sourced ethically, but also for the sake of your child. If at some point there are genetic diseases, God forbid, come up, it would be really great if your child could be in touch with their donor, with the person who gave them half of their DNA. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think it's important and very difficult to think about what kind of relationship you as a parent want with the woman who's donating eggs to you, and ultimately probably accepting the fact that your child will be able to contact this woman, you know, that she will not remain anonymous. And how do you talk to your kid or kids early enough about this so that it's not a secret?
Right, right.
And I think that's very deep and, you know, very, I think, challenging but important for people to think about ahead of time.
I do believe when you spend this much time reporting out one story, as you have for almost a year now with this piece, I think it changes you as a person and a reporter. How has reporting on this story changed each of you? Or what's going to stay with you from this?
When I began reporting on this story, I was very, very wary about some of the new frontiers of this industry, where the technology is really pushing the idea of how we conceive babies. And then I came out of this year of reporting, and it occurs to me that we are actually in probably a period that is not going to last for very long, because you have companies out there who are trying to figure out how to use stem cells to produce eggs and sperm in a petri dish. And I thought, well, we're going to have a whole new set of questions to deal with then about at what point we are crossing the line of how much you do in a lab. Say 20 years from now, instead of having to ask another woman to donate her egg to help you have a child, or, you know, a gay couple, it would be wonderful if they could use their own DNA, not to have to ask anyone else to go through a procedure like that and to be able to have their own baby.
Mm. For me, it led to a lot of thought about families and kind of the lengths that we go to both create, you know, the child that we want or think that we want, and then everything that happens afterwards. So for me, it was a meditation, I think, on, you know, parents' desires to control something that's uncontrollable. Mm-hmm. And then to accept the child that you have and the kind of relationship that you hopefully can have with the person who's made that possible.
Susan and Natalie, thank you both so much for your time. Thanks for coming in to talk about this.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You can read Natalie Obiko-Pearson and Susan Burfield's reporting for Bloomberg Businessweek about the global human egg trade in Apple News. We'll include a link to it on our show notes page. And if you're listening in the news app, the narrated article is queued up to play for you next.